Tango Tango Papa 1920, August 23rd, 2015.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from North Salt Lake City, Utah. So, let's see. The past few days I've been to Southern California. And then I went from Southern California to the Denver, Colorado area. And then I picked a load up this afternoon, or it was actually this morning in Fort Collins, and then that delivers tomorrow. Tomorrow being Monday, August the 24th, in Salt Lake City. And so, been staying very busy, really sort of bumping up next to running out of the hours of service. So I have to kind of keep a close watch on that at the moment. So in any case, I am due home by the 30th again for time off. And so am looking forward to that. So temperature-wise, it seems to me that it is the hot weather is over. I think in most in many areas of the country, the hot weather is gone. It's over. A lot of times, there's been plenty of summers where it will stay hot, maybe up until about Labor Day. Whenever, I'm not sure when, I'd have to look at the calendar and see when Labor Day is. It seems like that's sometime in, maybe September the 6th, somewhere in that area. But this year, I think it's already, that's already, the switch has been flipped. I was, looking at, some news headlines earlier. And Calgary, Alberta, Canada, I guess maybe yesterday, they were experiencing rain, and then it suddenly turned cold enough to cause the rain to freeze. So they had freezing rain plus snow. Now, I looked a while ago, I looked, and it said it was 70 degrees there. So I think it was just a one-day thing, but and they pretty much took it in stride, because it is Calgary, Alberta, after all, and they do get more than their fair share of bad weather as far as snow and ice and what have you. But there's plenty of other areas. For example, at home, its temperature has, you know, it's in the 70s, so the temperature, I think it really has kind of dropped a little bit earlier this year than it normally has, at least in the past number of years. But the weather is cyclical, and it's never the same. So you can't count on it always being the same all the time. It's just it doesn't work that way. So it is what it is, and that's, as I've said many times, that's why we build shelter. Because if we, unless we lived in some sort of a tropical area, if we tried to stay outdoors all the time, sooner or later we would die of exposure. So we have to be able to protect ourselves from the elements. Animals do it. There's plenty of except for trees, for example, are just out in the elements, but every animal pretty much makes some sort of a den, or it does something to protect itself. Animals, insects, and even trees. Trees go into a state where, during the winter, of course, they go into a state where they lose all their leaves, unless they're an evergreen type of tree. A deciduous tree, a leafy tree, loses its leaves typically, and if it's in a northern climate, and it kind of goes into a almost like a hibernation type of state. And then it, when the warmer weather rolls back around, the leaves come back, and it goes through its life cycle. So, but it's, but we do have to make shelter. And as I say, there are plenty of examples where animals do the same thing. Speaking of animals and human beings, people often attribute their emotions, and you see this all over the place, they attribute their emotions or emotions to, well, that's the, our emotions make us human, and that's not true. That's actually backwards. Our emotions do not make us human. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news if you're one of those people that believes that our emotions, being sensitive and being really emotional, is what makes us human. It's not it. Animals have emotions. There's plenty of animals have emotions. Your dog, if you've got a dog, your dog can get mad. Your cat can get mad. There are plenty of animals that can that have emotions that express some form of rudimentary emotions, and some of those emotions can be violent, especially with wild animals. So, animals have emotions. The difference is human beings. What is, you know, we have this intelligence that is far superior to any animal that you can name. Human beings have this intelligence, and then plus we have this separate perception of our own existence and this perception of right and wrong. And that's the other thing that separates us. But as human beings, the thing that makes us human is our intelligence and our ability to reason. And so therefore, if we are emotional and we descend into emotions and we allow emotions to rule our existence, if we allow emotions to instigate, to control our behavior, then we have failed as human beings. We become less human. So emotions, rather than making us human, it's actually emotions make us less human. And so therefore we should strive to be able to reason. And but that is the one of the big differences between human beings and animals. We've got this gigantic ability to reason, and so therefore we should make use of that. That's what makes us human, because if we didn't have the ability to reason, if we didn't have the perception of right and wrong, if we didn't have that, then we would just be animals, and we'd just be emotional, and we could just be as emotional as we wanted, and we would just be another primate. So it really is our ability to reason and our ability to perceive and think about, realize the difference between right and wrong and how we should exist and the way we and think about the way we exist. That is really what makes us human, is that ability. And so it's possible for us as individuals to either evolve or devolve within our own lifetimes. And so the more, if we become more sensitive and more to the environment and more emotional, then we're devolving. We're turning into animals. We're losing the, we're squandering the thing that makes it, that really sets us apart as human beings. And so this idea that emotions are what makes us human, you know, if you really think about it, that's backwards. It's completely backwards. And so this argument that I've just given throws that completely out the window. So when someone says, or you see some sign or something, or someone says some sappy thing about our emotions are what make us human, they're wrong. Because what makes us human is our ability to reason. What makes us human is our ability to perceive our own existence, to perceive the difference between right and wrong. And so, there's long been an argument about, you know, who says what is right and wrong. And morality, if you think about it, morality really flows out of the family unit. And so, you know, in a traditional family unit, we have a mom, and this can't be argued, it's biology, we have a mom and a dad, and then we have children. And if everything is functioning properly, the, you know, the mom kind of is taking care of the children to a large extent, and there's certain things that the mother is really good for, and the mother has instincts for, or the equivalent of instincts, and the same is true for the dad. The dad has a certain role to play, especially in regards to the upbringing of the children. And so morality really flows from that so-called nuclear family unit. And morality is kind of one of those things that it's kind of like health. In a sense, it's like health. If you're healthy, if you have your health, you don't even really know it. The only way you know that you've lost something, you've lost your health, then you might spend years and years and go to all kinds of doctors and take all kinds of medications to try to get your health back. But when you have health, you really don't even know that it's there. It's just there. And the only way you know that it's missing, that something's gone wrong with your health, is you're able to perceive that there's something wrong. And morality, the morality that flows out of the family unit is sort of similar. If everything is working right and the family is functional, then everything's fine. And so, but moral rules, moral laws kind of come about through the dysfunction that can take place in the family. So if you go back to the Adam and Eve story in the book of Genesis in the Bible, you know, Cain killed Abel. And Adam ended up using Eve. You know, he blamed Eve. You know, or God confronted at, why did you eat the fruit of the forbidden fruit, the fruit of the tree of knowledge and good and evil? Oh, the woman you gave me, she offered it to me. He blamed Eve. And so he was using Eve. And then Cain, their sons, one son killed the other one. Cain killed Abel. Now, obviously, the parents made a difference in their upbringing in order for that to happen. So one killed the other. So you can, if you look at that carefully and you think about that, moral laws, as far as thou shalt not murder, and you know, there's a whole bunch of things that you shouldn't do, that you're not supposed to do. You shouldn't rape, you shouldn't rob, you shouldn't pillage, you shouldn't murder. And as far as taking the name of God in vain, name actually also means nature. And so if you take the nature, you know, because we all, as human beings, we have this God-given nature. And if we end up playing God, trying to play God ourselves, we're taking the nature of our Creator in vain, because we've got a God-given nature. He endowed us with this God-given nature. You know, kind of like a little chip off the old block type of thing. And so when we use that to play God in our own minds, to sort of lord it over other people, that's taking the name of God in vain, or the nature of. Because name in the Bible always also means nature. And so if you look at the actual names in the Bible, the names, if you really want to get a deeper understanding of what's in the Bible, then look the names up, the meaning of the names. Because the names always add a lot of meaning to the story. So there's a one section and that, you know, where it just goes through a whole long list of, you know, like ancestry. You know, it goes through this whole list of so-and-so and so-and-so begat so-and-so, and you know, it goes on and on and on for a lengthy period, and that is actually, it's just more than the names, it's actually talking about states. Sort of states of existence, and if you want to develop a deeper understanding of the Bible, anywhere the word name appears, you can also substitute the word nature, and then the names, the actual meaning of the names, because every biblical name has a meaning. Those names also add to the story. You know, so, and in some cases, I think, what was it, Saul became Paul. So, you know, in some cases, the people got renamed because their nature changed. So, but morality really does flow out of what can go wrong in a family, and what can go wrong in a family always revolves around the one flaw that human beings have. We want to play God in our own minds. We want to believe, we have this proclivity, we want to believe that we're God. And it's, if you think about it, you know, we come into the world and we're sort of suddenly aware, we become aware of our own existence. And so, therefore, it's easy to look around. You become aware at some point, and it's hard to say when each one of us, it happens for each one of us, or it happened for me anyway. At some point, I don't know how old I was, but I kind of became aware, and I can't really pinpoint it, but I became aware of my own existence. And so you kind of look around and you think, well, where did all this stuff come from? Why do I exist? Isn't it strange that I exist? And then, but not only do I exist, but there's all, you know, this world around me and all these people and the universe and the stars and galaxies, etc., etc. I must have created it, it's the conclusion that we like to jump to, because we have this proclivity to want to believe that we're God when we're not. And, of course, the people around us will, you know, if we don't think that way already, they're going to help us think that way. They're going to trick us into thinking that way. How do they do it? By failing. Your parents fail you, and you resent them. You resent your parents. They're typically the first people that you deal with. You resent them, and that's all it takes. And you start playing, and you're playing God in your own mind, as if your resentment could strike people dead, as if you could hurl the mental thunderbolts and strike them dead. And that's really the best description that I've come up with for what resentment is. Resentment is one of those things. Resentment is also judgment. That's one of those things that it's, you know, you can try to come up with a word-based definition for it, but the words have a tendency to fall apart. And so you really have to come to an understanding of what resentment really is, of what judgment really is. And judging, you know, people think that judging is, well, you're looking at me and you see something wrong with me, you know, so therefore you're judging me, because, and then they twist that around in their mind, and you know, you're judging somebody unless you're affirming their, whatever it is that they're doing, whatever sin it is that they're engaged in, and you know, you have to be affirming and tell them, oh, it's really okay to, it's okay, so you're really doing a wonderful thing killing your baby. You're really doing just a bang-up job. You're really a great human being. That baby didn't want to live. It had no, you wouldn't want to bring that into this horrible world. You know, so people twist that around so that you have to, unless you're sucking on their ego, somehow you're judging them. And of course, that's not it. Judgment is resentment. And then, of course, the next step is to become proud of what resentment turns you into. Resentment makes you a slave, and then you instead of seeing that you're a slave, you, oh, this is a virtue. My slavery is a virtue. So then you have pride, you know, pride marches, abortion pride march, labor pride march, all kinds of pride marches. Be proud of what it turns you into. Change the laws, force everyone to affirm you, quote unquote, or you know, force everyone to tell you that you're really a wonderful person for doing what you're doing. And then, of course, when you sin, dust that off, that word off, put it back in the vocabulary. When you sin, what does it do? You think that it's going to, you know, and I thought this way. You know, you think, well, I'm going to do what makes me happy, quote unquote. And of course, the more you do that, and if what you're doing is a sin, which it usually is, of course, if you think it's going to make you happy somehow, especially if it's a sin that you're engaged in, it's not going to make you happy. It's going to make you, it's going to cause you to become depressed. There's about an 100% chance that it's going to cause you to become depressed. And then you think, then you want to blame somebody else for your, why am I depressed? Why, it must be because somebody's judging me. Must be those other people's fault. Then you have to have a scapegoat. Somebody else did it. So there's the reason that you don't want to sin. The reason that you don't want to, you know, rape, rob, murder, lust, pillage, so on and so forth, is not, you know, it's not because, well, if I try to adhere to these rules, then I'm going to end up in some heavenly afterlife or whatever. That's not it. You know, who knows what the afterlife is? We don't know. When you come out of the birth canal as a baby, you come out of the birth canal, you don't know what's on the other side. You have no clue. So we don't know what happens. But in the meantime, there's a real practical reason not to sin. And that practical reason is that it has an immediate impact on your well-being. It has an immediate impact on your existence. And that impact is negative. And it cannot be turned into something positive. Now, that's not to say that you can't be redeemed. That's a different story. Redemption is a different thing. But you engage in sin, whatever the sin is, and it has an immediate impact. And it's not just limited to physical acts. It's not, you know, you think, well, I'm not a murderer, and I'm not an adulterer, and I'm not a thief, and so etc. But do you engage in those thoughts in your mind? Do you murder in your mind? That's what resentment is. You think in your mind you're murdering the other person. It's people, places, and things. It's usually people, but it can be places and things as well. And so these things happen in the mind before they happen physically. So you engage in resentment, for example. And you can look like a nice person and a pleasant person and kind of keep it bottled up, smiling face, such a nice person. Then you end up with all kinds of horrible diseases. Lupus, and, you know, there's I don't know, there's a, I forget, it's a, there's like 100,000 or maybe even more than that, diseases that human beings can get. I should look that up. But there's this huge, huge number of diseases that human beings can get. How many diseases can your dog get? How many diseases can a raccoon get? Not that many. Very few, actually. How many diseases can a spider get? Or a tree? It's very limited. And yet, here we are, human beings. How many diseases can a monkey get? How many diseases can a gorilla get? Very similar. You get the right kind of monkey, very similar DNA. 98% or better, the same DNA that we have as human beings. 2% of our DNA is different. And yet somehow human beings get jillions of diseases. And the monkey, you know, that's monkey that's 98% the same DNA, has a very limited disease, spectrum of diseases that they can possibly get. Why is that? Why that is resentment. Plain and simple. So let me, I've been making myself a few notes here, so let me, kind of look through these. I think I talked about some of these. I've got my phone here, and it's got I've got the Note 4, and of course it has a stylus. And so typically what I do, and because I used to write, I'd write down on, like when I had a paper logbook, I would write down all these things on the paper logbook, and by the, you know, I'd have the logbook for a couple of months, and by the time I was done with the logbook, the 2 months had passed, and the thing would just be covered with all kinds of notes, and I would forget what the notes meant. So what I do with this Note 4, you pop the stylus out of it, and then it pops up, and you actually have a virtual notepad, you know, like a sticky note, yellow sticky note, and you know, you write on that and then save it, and it actually looks like a real sticky note that you've written on, but it's a virtual one. I was watching I watch a lot of stuff, science stuff. And that includes stuff about the brain. And so I was watching this show. And they were, in the show, they were talking about, it was a documentary type show, and they were talking about, you remember the movie Rain Man, starring Dustin Hoffman? And that was actually based on a real story, a real person. The character that Dustin Hoffman played is actually a real person. His name escapes me at this point. But so this was about autism, because the character that Dustin Hoffman played was really autistic, and he was sort of there's a term that they use. It's escaping me at the moment. But in this case, this real guy, and I wish I could remember his name. But in any case, this guy can't take care of himself. The fellow's, you know, he's probably in his 50s at this point, and his brother is kind of around taking care of him. But he can't take care of himself, but he can rattle off all kinds of facts. And he reads, all he has to do, he can just read, but he can go through a book and just turn the pages, and he has virtually perfect recall about, you know, what is written. It's remarkable. Absolutely remarkable what his brain is able to do. But the problem is that he has no social ability. His social ability is virtually, you know, it's crippling. It's he couldn't live were it not for his brother taking care of him. He wouldn't be able to function. And so the idea with autism, it's interesting. You know, people wonder what it is, and people have different theories, of course, as to what it is. And of course, they're studying brains and behaviors. Autistic kids typically will end up, it's, you know, they'll seem normal at first, and they may even begin to talk and sort of develop, you know, they're developing normally, and then all of a sudden something happens and they instantly regress. And it may be, and this is just a theory, but it may be there's some sort of an infection that happens, or some sort of you know, in the brain, or it could be that something just goes wrong in the development process. And then suddenly the parts of the brain that would normally be dedicated to being, to enable the individual to function normally as a social creature, social human being in the world, that part of the brain suddenly, you know, something goes wrong. And the brain, the brain's very interesting, because if, you know, those brain cells want something, it's almost like they want something to do. And so they will, you know, if one part, you know, it's interesting, because if, you know, you have somebody, let's say you have somebody that loses a part of their body, they lose an arm or they lose a leg, what ends up happening, they still have feeling in that limb that's no longer there. And oftentimes they'll experience pain. And that pain can be actually be quite devastating. It can be very distracting. They feel pain. Now they've done some interesting things. You know, there's this what's this guy's name? Dr. Chandra. He's done some interesting stuff with mirrors, and it's interesting because you know, he gets these people that, you know, so let's say they've lost an arm or whatever, but yet they're experiencing all kinds of pain. He set up this light, this box with a mirror in it, so that they're able to sort of see a mirror reflection of their, you know, in this case it would be an arm, so that they would be able to see this mirror reflection of their arm, so that it would, to the brain's point of view, when they're looking in this box, it's like they're seeing the limb that's not there. They're seeing a mirror image of it. And it's really remarkable, because then they're able to sort of relax. After a few minutes they're to practice with this mirror, this in the box, they're actually often able to relax that phantom arm. And so what's happening is that the brain is actually, the cells, the brain cells, for these different areas of the body, you know, because you have this body map that can actually be mapped out in terms of brain cells, that, you know, kind of keep track of each, you know, they're sort of aware of each part of the body, among other things, and it's probably really simplifying it. But those brain cells, if there's, you know, they will, if they don't have anything to do, they'll sort of take over, they'll add to or try to share stimulation of the brain cells that are adjacent to them. So in other words, instead of a like a normal whatever part of the brain map that would be responsible for, let's say, an arm, for example, a left arm or a right arm, that part might be right next to an area of the face, for example. And so if the arm isn't there, then that can end up, those brain cells will remap to the face, for example, so that they've got input. So I think that what is happening, and this is just my theory, but and I think some other people have expressed the same theory, but I think what's happening is that, you know, what for whatever reason the development in an case of autism goes wrong, or acquired savant syndrome, where somebody gets hit on the head and then they end up with musical ability, all kinds of musical ability or whatever that they didn't have before, or some, you know, they end up kind of becoming a genius at doing something that they just didn't have that ability before, and it was because their brain was damaged. So I think what happens is that the social part of an autistic person's brain, for whatever reason, that becomes scrambled, or the development process interfered with in some way that we don't understand. And so those brain cells that would normally be taking, you know, kind of handling social interaction, those brain cells can be devoted to math, for example. When somebody can be like this guy inspired the Rain Man movie, I don't remember if he's mathematical, but if he can do the math, I think, because he may also do math as well, but he's just an absolute, seems to have an infinite amount of storage when it comes to being, he reads so many books a day. It's remarkable. And he has virtually perfect recall of all those books that he just goes through them, you know, page after page, and has perfect recall. And so, you know, and then people, he appears before audiences, and people will throw out different questions, and he is able to rattle off answers, you know, and typically they're questions about history, historical figures, trivia, that type of thing, and because he has so much knowledge, he just rattles it right off, dates, it's quite remarkable. And there's other cases in this show that I watched, there are other cases where they show other types of savants. Idiot savant is the term, actually. So, you know, because in a sense they're an idiot because they don't have any social skills, they can't function on their own, you know, but yet they are a savant in, usually a single area, or maybe one or two areas, where they display absolutely remarkable abilities that the average person wouldn't have. But they, you know, typically they lack social skills, and so who knows? They continue to study this, but who knows why? What's going on? Is there some sort of an infection that happens, or is it simply a development? Something goes wrong developmentally. We just don't know. But those brain cells that should go to social, being able to function socially, recognize faces, recognize intent. Intent, the people around you, be able to joke and have double meanings and et cetera, et cetera. That all goes out the window. And, but, you know, yet they have these, you know, those brain cells end up sort of repurposing themselves. I've talked about it before. There's this term, you know, we think it's, you know, genetics, and for a long time people thought that your genes, whatever your genes were in your cells, whatever your genes were, that just, that determined who you were, and you know, and it sort of, and people still have this idea that the your genes precisely determine what you look like and who you are, and that's not true, because there's what they've discovered is epigenetics. Look that up. Epigenetics. And so you have this gene set, and your genes really work like a blueprint. And so you use, you know, it's using the blueprint as you develop, as an individual, you got this blueprint, but then you're also reacting to the outside world. And so who we become, what we become, is not only determined by, you know, it's influenced by our genetic blueprint, certainly, but it's also our environment and how we react to that environment, what happens to us in that environment, and also throw into that mix the parents, what your parents did, because what your parents do also ends up affecting the child's DNA. And so the Bible statement, the sins of the fathers are visited on the third and fourth generation, saith the Lord. That's absolutely true. And they're proving it genetically. So what you do determines, you know, does end up having a measurable impact on your offspring. So throw that into the mix as well. So, but, you know, it's very interesting. The Bible is full, just chock full, and it's not only the Bible, but the Bible is full of statements, and people would love to just, they love to, oh, that's superstition, you know, and then besides that, then you have intuition. You know, most people have intuition, there's some sort of intuition, unless they drowned it out and are separated from it. But you've got intuition, and you've got a conscience. And if you're really in tune with that conscience, you know, that conscience will be your guide. And you can have your own BS detector. You can know the difference between right and wrong. You don't have to have someone telling you that this is right or this is wrong. You're able to see it for yourself. And you're able to learn things. The best kind of learning is if you learn out of your own curiosity. And it's possible to know things without knowing how you know. And that's really the best kind of knowing. That really is the best kind of knowing, to know, to be able to know something without knowing how you know. You know, what is one and one? one and one is two, but how do you know that it's two? Is it because someone told you that it was two? Or you're able to see it for yourself? The best thing is if you can see it for yourself. So I believe, you know, the Alzheimer's, getting back to the brain thing, I believe Alzheimer's probably is an autoimmune disease. Of course, they continue to study it, but the brain is, the human brain is just horrifically complicated. It's a very complicated thing, and it's very possible. Because hey, I listened to all kinds of things and watched things about the brain, and I was listening to this guy, and he was they've only recently discovered that there's a limbic system in the brain. The limbic system helps carry waste away. And so they didn't even realize that there was a limbic system in the brain, that was there. So is it possible that and this is just speculation, is it possible that Alzheimer's is an accumulation of waste, because something's gone wrong with the immune system, and it's attacked. Maybe the immune system's attacked the waste removal system, and then the thing just clogs up, and eventually it goes completely haywire and quits functioning. There's all kinds of autoimmune diseases. And the thing with autoimmune diseases, what you have to understand, the body is at war with itself. It mistakes its own, you could say almost its brother cells. It mistakes its own cells or at least the cells that it has DNA in common with. It mistakes them for the enemy. And then with an autoimmune disease, the immune system begins to attack. Let's say it begins to, like in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, it begins to attack the joint as if it was the enemy. It's a foreign invader. You know, and that's just one example. There's all kinds of different autoimmune diseases. My personal belief is that that is brought about by what? Does it just naturally happen? Does it? No. It's brought about by, there's this rotten, wicked ego that sort of inhabits the body. And that is what brings it about. And what enables that rotten, wicked ego is resentment. Whether you're aware of it or not. That's why it's a deadly thing to think that resentment is just, you want to keep it around like it's some sort of a piece of chocolate or something that you got your little chocolate stash that you can jump into every once in a while. people think that they can turn resentment into something good. And it's good to get mad. It's good to rage. No, it's not. You burn up. So, anyway, getting back to the morality, if someone, you know, someone, I was on Facebook, and I've been on Facebook a lot lately, and I've been, in some cases, you know, I've ended up in an argument a little bit. I, you know, wasn't really arguing, but they were arguing with me about Donald Trump, and, but in some, you know, somebody said, well, the truth hurts. And what I realized was, the reason, if the truth hurts, how is it that the truth could hurt you? How is it that the truth could hurt you? And the only way that the truth can hurt you is if you're delusional. You're living in a delusion. You've created some sort of fantasy. And then the truth becomes painful. The truth becomes the enemy. And so, for example, socialists are morally delusional. It's easy to see. They are morally delusional. Because the real morality, real truth, is their enemy. And so they want to try to recreate, you know, sort of an external scaffolding in the form of socialism, sort of this external thing to sort of negate the truth, negate the existence of a creator. Negate the relationship that functional human beings need in order to, you know, we have this, if we're functional human beings, we have this relationship to our creator. And it's not the religious type that you think it is. Oftentimes that's fake and phony as it can get. But we have this, where the rubber meets the road, we have this, if we're functional, we have this relationship with our creator. You know, and we often know of it as conscience. Let your conscience be your guide, says Jiminy Cricket. So, if you're functional, you're able to, you know, you go about your existence. And it's, you know, serendipity, and you know, you don't even realize that you're happy. There's nothing to realize. It's just, it's happiness is one of those things that the only way you know when it's missing, because you're unhappy. But when you're happy, happy is not an emotion. But socialists see that as the enemy, and so they try to destroy that, as do it through the school system, destroy the kids' natural relationship with their creator, destroy the morality that comes out of the family unit, destroy the family unit, and turn the state into a sort of an externalized god. And so therefore they're morally delusional. Socialism, communism, they're morally delusional. Very simple. So anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead. That went by quick. That's amazing. It's been 61 minutes. And it feels like it's just a couple of minutes have gone by. It's amazing. Better be cutting this off. Hope everyone has had a great weekend. Hope you have a great week coming up. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.